From the Christian Research Institute in Charlotte, North Carolina, this is the Bible Answer Man broadcast with Hank Hanegraaff. We're on the air because truth matters, life matters more. On today's special edition of the Bible Answer Man, we pick up where we ended on our previous broadcast and present more of an episode of the Hank Unplugged podcast. Hank is talking with Oxford-educated classicist Dr. Spencer Clavin, author of How to Save the West, Ancient Wisdom for Five Modern Crises. Let's now join Hank Hanegraaff and Spencer Clavin in their conversation.
Honestly, Spencer, I would buy this book if it were just based on the first crisis, the crisis of reality. And I want you to delineate for our audience what the crisis of reality entails.
Thank you. Yes, happily. So we begin in that first chapter with Mark Zuckerberg's kind of infamous announcement that he was going to rocket his company, Facebook, forward into Web3, and it was going to become Meta. And what that meant is that it was going to be a more of an immersive kind of experience where you're going to, instead of logging on and you see a screen with your friends' notifications on it, you're going to put on a headset or use some other device so that all around you, the world looks different. An ever-changing world beyond your world is waiting, is one of the advertisements that they released during this time. And you stop for a second and you realize, you know, this, of course, is the subject of like half of the dystopian science fiction that people will know about, The Matrix, right? All these comparisons have been made. And you say, well, so why, if this is supposed to be the big new thing, if this is supposed to be the next step in man's triumph over nature, we're going to, you know, sail forward into a bright future, why do I feel so queasy about it? And why do all these other authors of, you know, stories like The Matrix, or, you know, you might think of Wall-E here, or indeed the novel Snow Crash, where the word metaverse was coined, why do all these authors seem to think of this as like a dystopian and unpleasant step in the wrong direction? And what you realize then is that, of course, what we're really facing up against when somebody offers us a virtual reality headset as the key to our future is not the question, you know, whether we might like to play a video game where things kind of look like they're moving around us, but the question, what is real? What actually matters, right? Because if the only thing that's real is the thing that I can construct with my mind, can trick my senses into believing, then all sorts of nasty and unpleasant things follow. Like, for instance, you know, if the things around me are just figments of my imagination, well, then aren't you just a figment of my imagination? And isn't even my own body sort of a figment of my imagination? And why shouldn't I just reconfigure everything according to my will, my desires, my pleasure? And as you start to lay it out that way, you realize this is a very, very old proposition. In fact, it's the proposition in some ways with which Western philosophy begins, or at least Athenian Greek philosophy begins in Athens with a conflict between Plato's Socrates. So Socrates, the great kind of barefoot teacher, and his student Plato, who wrote down kind of narrative accounts of his life and teaching and some of what it meant to him and those around him. As Plato depicts it, and this is, you know, kind of really the big bang, if you like, of Greek philosophy, there was a fundamental conflict at stake between Socrates and the other kind of professional teachers that got called the sophists. And now in our English language, we have the word sophistry, right? Which means just somebody that kind of lets off all sorts of rhetorical fireworks, but is really just selling you kind of snake oil. And that's because of Plato that we think of them that way, right? And that's the, you know, we have sophists everywhere in our society, right? Sophistry is a human perennial. In some ways, it's the natural state of thinking man. If I can think my way into arguing, or as they used to call it, making the weaker argument the stronger, well, then I can get anything I want. And what Socrates is identifying, Plato's Socrates in the dialogues is identifying, is that actually what that is it sounds sophisticated, but it's actually a recipe for violence and anarchy. And there are all sorts of episodes that I go into the book from Greek history that kind of play this out, including, not limited to, the condemnation of Socrates himself, right, as being the kind of sophist par excellence. All the people that, all the powerful power brokers in Athenian society didn't like very much that Socrates was pointing this out. He ended up being forced to commit suicide by the Athenian state. And ever since then, we have recurring throughout our history been in this battle between the sort of trendy attractiveness of relativism and the difficult but life-giving and meaning-giving issue of reality. Is anything real, whether you want it to be, whether you choose it to be or not? And I argue in the second chapter of that section that either something is real somewhere, or we are doomed to just more of the kind of anarchic violence that you saw, for instance, under the Stalinist regime in the Soviet Union, another place that was famous for arguing that nothing is either good or bad, but thinking makes it so. And that's the question that we're confronted with. And those are our only two options.
Yeah. So if you collapse the distinction between the real and the virtual, can you then maintain a distinction between good and evil?
You know, I think a lot of people imagine that you could. It's a great question, by the way. And I suspect that, you know, somebody like Zuckerberg, in some of his public statements, which I go into in the book, you know, he starts to say, well, you'll be able to see a new reality, right? You won't just see the old reality, you also see a new reality. Or there's another person who uses the phrase reality privilege, right? You just want to stay in your world because you have it good, but shouldn't we be creating new realities in front of our imaginary world? And right, this is basically an imaginary physical reality that we're being invited to create. But the problem with this, of course, is that actually reality doesn't just stop at the physical. And you may well believe, as many people in ancient Athens did, that you can simply say, well, you know, the world that we can see and touch, that's kind of what we make of it. But we can still kind of live nice, upright, respectable lives. And basically, what I argue in the book is that this is the perennial mistake. It's kind of, you only go, it's halfway relativism. And we learn again and again that if physical reality is kind of up for grabs, is a construct purely of the human mind, then all the things on which we base our moral reality is also up for grabs. And everything becomes kind of a struggle for power. The person who recognized this in his day, maybe unexpected kind of citation in a book like this, but the person who recognized this was Friedrich Nietzsche. And Nietzsche is somebody with whose conclusions I strongly disagree, as I imagine many people reading the book will also disagree as they read about him. And yet, what made him a visionary is that he lived also during a time when absolute truth, and specifically God, right? Specifically, the conviction that there was a final arbiter of what is and is not, both in the physical and the moral sphere, right? He lived in a time when people were tossing that conviction just casually out the window, as indeed we do today, and imagining fondly that all their nice moral codes were going to stay in place. And the point of Nietzsche's famous saying that God is dead, which is in the words actually of a madman in the public square, is that the madman is the only one who can see that you can't just toss God out and not lose the entire structure, the entire civilization, the entire moral code that was built on religious beliefs and on the belief in absolute truth. Here's an easy example. You know, the brotherhood of man, right? The nice notion which you get in, for instance, the UN Declaration of Human Rights, that all men are brothers. Everybody is created equal, as we put it in this country. Well, if they're created equal, created by whom, right? And if they're brothers, then who's their father? And you realize that these things start to, in fact, break down, as they're now doing when we start to argue, well, this kind of person, it's not really a person in the womb, that's not really a person, right? We can get rid of that person if it feels good to us, if it seems necessary. And so even before the metaverse, right, long before we proposed to redefine the terms of reality using technology, we were already in this position of thinking that we could have our cake and eat it too. But in fact, the historical and the logical philosophical justification for many of our moral beliefs, the imago Dei, the common brotherhood of man created in the image of God being a classic example, is only going to last out of habit for a few generations after you toss God out. And then, as we're already seeing, it's going to start to break down. So these things are all connected. And that's something that I think we, unless we think hard about them, we sort of tend to miss.
I got to tell you, when I watch you speak, I just trip. You remind me so much of my son-in-law. He's a professor of philosophy at the Air Force Academy in Colorado Springs.
Huh. Wow.
And his intellectual firepower is at a pretty high level. And when I listen to you speak, I think I'm watching him.
Wow, that's an honor. I'm touched.
Yeah, well, I have a great appreciation for people that have studied to show themselves approved and can communicate concepts in a very articulate way.
Oh, thank you. I thought you were going to say I sounded like my dad, because the only family heirloom in our family is that every man sounds exactly the same. But that's a separate question.
But, you know, you probably suffer from a particular malady, and that's reality privilege. You actually talk about this in the book. If you prefer non-virtual life, a particular engineer was talking about, if you prefer non-virtual life over virtual reality, then you have a malady called reality privilege.
That's right. As long as we're adding to the list of available privileges, I don't see why we shouldn't throw reality privilege in there too. You've got white privilege, you've got every kind of privilege, male privilege, so on and so forth. I think I saw one article, by the way, just as a side note, that argued something like, straight black men are the white men of black people. This was like this lefty kind of social justice warrior arguing that within these communities, then you have like privilege within privilege.
Don't go away. In just a few moments, we'll rejoin Hank Hanegraaff's conversation with scholar Spencer Klavan. In his new book, How to Save the West, Oxford-educated classicist Spencer Klavan writes for people who want to save the West but don't know how. The fate of our civilization depends on whether ordinary people internalize the truth and beauty conveyed in the masterpieces of Western culture. Dr. Klavan defends that culture and explains why and how we must hand it on to the next generation. Be sure to read How to Save the West, Ancient Wisdom for 5 Modern Crises. To receive your copy, call 888-7000-CRI and make a gift to support the Christian Research Institute's mind-shaping, life-changing outreaches. 888-7000-CRI or go online to equip.org. That's equip.org.
Truth matters, life matters more, details Hank Hanegraaff's personal pilgrimage from his long defense of truth to his discovery that life matters more. Essentially two books in one, Part 1 equips Christians to defend the essential truths of the historic Christian faith. Part 2 explains why truth is necessary, but hardly sufficient. That the map is not the territory, the menu is not the meal. We are created to experience life to the full through union with God in Christ. Is there more to the Christian life than what you are experiencing? Truth Matters, Life Matters More unveils the unexpected beauty of an authentic Christian life. To receive Truth Matters, Life Matters More for yourself or as a terrific gift to a friend or loved one, call 888-7000-CRI and make a gift to support the Christian Research Institute's life-changing outreaches, 888-7000-CRI, or visit us online at equip.org.
Bertrand Russell famously said, "Most people would rather die than think, and many of them do. Not so with CRI support team members. Support team members are not only serious thinkers, but their membership in CRI's support team helps to equip hundreds of thousands of fellow believers around the globe each and every month. Are you not a member? Then you're missing out. Not only do support team members form the backbone of Christian Research Institute's outreaches, but they enjoy their selection of resources from our Equipping Essentials library and receive a complimentary subscription to CRI's award-winning Christian Research Journal. Just two of the benefits of membership. To discover how you can make a difference 24/7 in equipping believers at home and abroad to stand for life and truth, check out the benefits of membership at equip.org. Has God spoken? Are the words of Scripture merely human in origin, or are they in fact the very words of God Himself? 3 years in the making and based on 2 decades of research and reflection, Hank Hanegraaff's monumental book, Has God Spoken?, answers what is surely the most important question facing our world. In Has God Spoken? Memorable Proofs of the Bible's Divine Inspiration, Hank counters the contentions of the Bible attackers and clearly shows that belief in the Holy Scriptures is not a guess or wishful thinking. It is the only logical conclusion after an honest examination of overwhelming evidence. Order Has God Spoken from the Christian Research Institute by calling 888-7000-CRI or go online to equip.org. Equip.org. In his new book, How to Save the West, Spencer Clavin writes, Western civilization is not some ethnic or tribal marker designed to keep undesirables out. Just the opposite. It is a set of ideas and masterpieces shared among people from an enormous range of races and times. Nor is Western thought a kind of dogma, a set of points to which all Westerners must ascribe. In this book, says Dr. Clavin, we will discuss philosophers like Karl Marx and David Hume, who I believe represent wrong turns and dead ends in the Western journey. But they are Westerners too, and I criticize them because I think our shared heritage points in another, better direction. To receive your copy of How to Save the West, Ancient Wisdom for Five Modern Crises, call 888-7000-CRI and make a gift to support the Christian Research Institute's mind-shaping, life-changing outreaches. 888-7000-CRI. Or go online to equip.org. That's equip.org. Let's rejoin Bible Answer Man host Hank Hanegraaff and his guest, classicist Spencer Clavin, in their conversation.
As long as we're adding to the list of available privileges, I don't see why we shouldn't throw reality privilege in there too. You've got white privilege, you've got every kind of privilege, male privilege, so on and so forth. So reality privilege, and this is, I think, a phrase that comes from Bo Cronin, the software developer. Reality privilege is the idea that you only resist the whole notion of virtual reality, the whole deconstruction of true and false, because things are good for you in the real world, here and now. Maybe you have a nice house, maybe you don't suffer from any illnesses, you're not debilitated in any way like that. But most people for most of history have had to face up to all sorts of pain and difficulty and deprivation. And so why shouldn't we just upload their consciousnesses into the cloud? Why shouldn't we just kind of inject into their brains some new idea, right, that actually everything's good? And the funny thing about this is, you know, you can take it pretty seriously, right? You can say, well, it is true, of course, that reality as we find it constituted, true and false, have all kinds of inconvenient and in some cases tragic and unfair and sorrowful consequences. And nobody would blame a person with a degenerative disease from wanting to look into technology that could heal or fix it. Of course not. That's not what we're talking about at all. But what I try to stress in the book is that the desire for there to be true and false, independent of my personal will, is actually not based on things going well or badly. It's based on wanting things to have meaning. And that is something I think meaning is a concept that we either don't pay much attention to at all, or we say we can just construct it for ourselves. But in fact, meaning is something crucial, central, core to the human person, to human life. You want it to matter when you succeed, right? And so I give in the book the example of, you know, we all know that if you play Call of Duty and you take a bullet for your buddy that's playing next to you, it's not the same thing as if you are a soldier who actually, God forbid, has to take a bullet for his buddy in real life, in meat space, as they say online. And why is that? Well, because we know that there are consequences in reality, in the real world, when we live and we operate in the parameters of true and false. And if we break down those parameters, I'm skeptical that we'll ever actually be able to do it. But if we do, if we take those barriers away, things can just be, you know, one way today and another way tomorrow, depending on how we feel. We may have gained a fair amount of pleasure, but I think we'll find that it crumbles to dust in our hands. Because what is pleasure if there's no such thing as, you know, absolutely good? It's just a kind of sensory stimulation. So yeah, I mean, like, the easy accusation is, well, you just think everything's going so well that you don't want to change, you don't want any technological development. That's not the situation here at all. What I'm trying to stress is that if you want to play the game, you have to know the rules. And if you just say there are no rules, then actually everything kind of begins to lose any significance at all. You think that's going to be fun, but after a while, it's just madness.
I want you to expand on two people that you brought up in the conversation thus far. One is Mark Zuckerberg and the other is Plato. So here's a characterization of what you say in the book, where you have Mark Zuckerberg striding like a lord among a crowd of patrons, and they have on these virtual reality headsets. On the inside, they're experiencing wonders untold. From an outside perspective, they look like people in Plato's cave. So in your metaverse experience, you feel like a superhero, but objectively, you look like you're brain dead. So expand on this in relationship to Plato's cave.
I'm really glad that you raised this, because I mentioned offhand just a moment ago that I'm skeptical we'll ever actually achieve the total breakdown of true and false, real and unreal, that we seem to kind of long for. And I don't believe it would be a good thing if we did achieve it, but I also note that never in history have these kind of pure relativist regimes ever succeeded. They always collapse under their own weight. And there's a very important reason why that I think is captured in that image, which people may have seen, the press releases of Mark Zuckerberg kind of striding through an auditorium and everybody around him is strapped into the virtual reality headset. It's not to pick on Zuckerberg particularly. I think he's a good representative of a view that obtains in Silicon Valley generally. But the thing that that photograph does is it gives us a third person view, an outside view, and it pulls back the camera, you might say, right? So let's say I'm totally immersed in my virtual reality world and everything seems great. It's still possible for those of us outside of the virtual reality world to look at people with the headset on and see a very different reality. And either that other person's idea of us, vision of us, matters, has some truth value, or it doesn't. Either other people matter and can see things that are real, or they don't. And that's another reason why virtual reality and human morality are so crucially interwoven, right? This is the point of Plato's famous cave. We've maybe all heard of this moment in Book 7 of the Republic, where Plato Socrates says, we can compare human nature in respect of education to people who are trapped at the bottom of the cave. They were born there, they're chained to the wall, and all they see are the kind of shadows projected from a fire by these little puppet masters who operate these puppets, these images of truth. And we're never quite sure, but it seems like those puppet masters are the artists in a society, the politicians, the sophists that I mentioned earlier. If we were making a modern Plato's cave, Mark Zuckerberg might be one of the people holding up the puppets, right? Or you might have the guys at Davos who are meeting to decide the fate of the world, right? These people who kind of know half-truths and they use them to deceive the masses. And what Plato's cave, again, does is it pulls back the camera and shows you that even if you completely believe what you see in front of your eyes in the cave, if you are totally immersed in virtual reality, there is a standpoint from which you are made weak and small by that exchange. Iris Murdoch, who is one of Plato's kind of modern disciples and who saw the horrors of the Nazi regime in World War II and sort of realized there must be something absolute about morality, she has this wonderful line in which she says, love, and so art and morals, consists in the very difficult realization that something other than oneself is real. And in some ways, that sums up everything that I'm arguing for in that first section of the book, that you cannot have the world of meaning, the world of morals, the world of love that we all know is better, is good, is better than the opposite. You can't have that world without believing that there are people and things outside of you, that you're not the only will, the only desire, the only thing that exists or matters in the universe.
One more question. I want to move on. There's so much more that can be unpacked, and you do unpack in terms of the crisis of reality. But something seminal that caught my attention in your book is the significance of the embodied life in terms of reality. And we've seen this come to fruition in many different ways through the COVID crisis, for example. But you also see this in terms of patterns of behavior that have been established in society as a result of Zoom. So now you can do church not as an embodied experience, but you could do church on Zoom. So virtual reality has huge ramifications, particularly if people buy into the virtual experience as opposed to the embodied experience.
That's absolutely right. I mean, the second crisis that I address in the book is the crisis of the body. And this, I think, is something we all are feeling keenly, whether we know it or not. We have this sort of easy, breezy materialist mindset, this set of assumptions that just operates in the background of the world, that, you know, that everything's just made out of stuff, out of meat, that human beings, you can hear this online, they're just meat sacks with chemistry sets inside. And basically what we're doing is just manipulating our sort of physical surroundings so that our minds can feel as good as possible. And you can read people like Yuval Noah Harari, who writes in his book, Homo Deus, about the mystery of consciousness. Why is it that if everything is just atoms bouncing around, if everything is just matter, why is it that we have this stream of sensations, desires, loves, dreams, emotions, aspirations? At some point he says, if everything that happens to us is mechanical when we, say, run away from a mountain lion, if that's just a chemical reaction triggering other physical movements, then why do we need to feel fear?
We'll have to stop here for today's special edition of the Bible Answer Man broadcast. Join us again next time when we'll continue Hank Hanegraaff's conversation with scholar Spencer Klavan. Our firm commitment here at the Christian Research Institute is to defend the faith once for all delivered to the saints and equip believers to become true disciples of Jesus Christ. In appreciation for your vital gift to help strengthen and expand CRI's mind-shaping, life-changing outreaches, Hank would like to send you a copy of How to Save the West, Ancient Wisdom for Five Modern Crises by Dr. Spencer Klavan. Call a resource consultant at 888-7000-CRI, 888-7000-CRI, or visit our website, equip.org. That's equip.org. You can also write CRI at Post Office Box 8500, Charlotte, North Carolina, zip code 28271. The Bible Answer Man broadcast is funded by listeners like you. We're on the air because truth matters, life matters more.
Truth Matters, Life Matters More by Hank Hanegraaff is essentially two books in one. Because Truth Matters, Part 1 equips Christians to defend the essential truths of the historic Christian faith. In Part 2, Hank explains why life matters more and how we can experience the height of human existence, union with God in Christ. Simply put, the map is not the territory, the menu is not the meal. We cheat ourselves of authentic union with Christ when we elevate the message above the Messiah. Truth Matters, Life Matters More is a modern classic and the magnum opus of one of the great theological minds of our time. To receive Truth Matters, Life Matters More, simply call 888-7000-CRI and make a gift in support of the life-changing work of the Christian Research Institute. That's 888-7000-CRI or go online to equip.org.